The question I'd like to ask you as we come to these chapters is, are you thinking of leaving Jesus? Are you thinking of giving up being a Christian? I wonder if you've grown weary in the Christian life to the extent that you think, I'm going to stop being a Christian. I've had enough. I don't know, maybe circumstances in your life are changing. Maybe you've come to the end of the academic year and you're moving on to something new and you think, actually, next year or on this summer, it'll be easier if I just put the Christian life to one side. Are you thinking of leaving Jesus? Or maybe there's a particular sin that you're battling with and you've grown so weary in the battle and you think, you know what, it's not worth it. Are you thinking of leaving Jesus? Are you thinking of giving up in the Christian life? Or maybe there's a relationship that you're in that isn't compatible with following Jesus. And so you're weighing up relationship with the person I really love or Jesus. Are you thinking of leaving Jesus? I was doing the park run yesterday morning and I thought, good day for it, I'll try and go as hard as I can. And I got to about 1 kilometre to go and I was this close to giving up. Thankfully, I didn't. Spared myself that embarrassment. But I saw the people walking along the side, the path on the side, and I really wanted to be like them, and I almost gave up. Whatever stage of the Christian life you're at, whether you're 10 or nearly 100, are you thinking of leaving Jesus? Are you thinking of giving up on the Christian life? That's the situation that the people of Exodus are in by the time we get to chapter 15. They're wandering through the desert and they're tempted to wander from the Lord. They're tempted to turn their backs on the one who rescued them. And up to this point in the book of Exodus, the spotlight has been very much on the Lord. But now the spotlight switches to the people of God and what they're like and what they go through. And first of all, we see the route that they take. And to summarise it so far, you're probably familiar with it, we can say slavery in Egypt, Red Sea. I mean, you could go back further than that, but we'll just go back. Slavery in Egypt, Red Sea, and then in today's passage we get wilderness, or the desert. That's where we are today. And the thing that jumps out about this route is that it's not an easy place to be. The desert is not a fun place to be. Yes, they've been miraculously rescued by the Lord from slavery in Egypt. They've come through the Red Sea, and maybe we're expecting the Lord to come down with a luxury jumbo jet and whiz them straight off to the Promised Land. But no, instead you get this period of testing in the wilderness where the Lord comes and gives his people trials. He doesn't whiz them straight off. He gives them trials in the wilderness. And the first place they come to is this is a three kind of stop journey that we're going to look at this evening. The first place they come to is called Marah, verse 22 of chapter 15. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Marah. This journey isn't fun. This route they're taking isn't fun. I don't know whether you've ever been in that situation where you're really, really thirsty. Well, these people have been traveling in the desert for 3 days, no water. And then they find water, and they think, great, water. But then they can't drink it because it's bitter. It's tough. It's not fun. Secondly, on their route, they come to a place called Elim, and then the desert of Sin. And again, there's problems. Again, it's hardship and trial. So skip on to chapter 15, verse 27. We're going to have a map, but the technology's not working. So just kind of imagine a map up on there. We've come to Marah. We then move up to Elim. Anyway, verse 27. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees. Great. And they camped there near the water. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat round pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." We'll come to the grumbling in a minute, but for now, we just need to realize that this is not five-star luxury peaches and cream Christianity. This is hard. This is the desert. This is wilderness. This is thirsty, hungry work. The people of God are being tested. Next stop, Rephidim, a place we all know well, I'm sure. Chapter 17, verse 1, skipping right to chapter 17. Don't worry, we'll come back to some other bits in between. And again, problems. The whole Israelite community set out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. The route God's people are having to take to get from the Red Sea, the Promised Land, is hard. It's the desert. It's the wilderness. The destination is going to be great, they're told. But in between, before you get there, the journey is going to be hard. That's the thing about journeys, isn't it? They're often not very pleasant. I think one of the most enjoyable family holidays I've ever been on was in 1995, before most of you were born. I went on a family holiday to Croatia, and I'd never been to Croatia before, and it was amazing. Probably one of the best 2 weeks of my life. Banana boating, swimming in pools and the sea. But the thing I remember about the holiday, actually, is the horrible journey that involved two flights, a boat journey in the middle of the night, and I was really, really grumpy. The destination was amazing, better than anything I'd ever seen before. The journey was horrible. It was really, really grim. And the promised land that we stand to inherit as the new covenant people of God is better than anything you could ever imagine. We can't get our heads around how good it's going to be. But the journey there is grim. This world is not what being a Christian is about. The destination, the promised land, the new creation is what being a Christian is about. We're in the desert. In Acts 14, verse 22, the apostles are speaking to people who have just become Christians. And they say, we must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God. The verse doesn't say, sometimes some people might have to go through some hardships to enter the kingdom of God. We, in other words, Christians, must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God. The geography of the Old Testament, I guess, tells us that, doesn't it? It's not, as we said before, it's not Red Sea, promised land. It's Red Sea, wilderness, promised land. I think we sometimes forget that. Red Sea, wilderness, promised land. And there are some parts of the church that will tell you it's Red Sea, promised land. Come to Jesus and all your diseases will be healed. Come to Jesus and you'll find the man or woman of your dreams. Come to Jesus and all your problems will be solved and life will be a breeze. That's not what the Bible teaches. We're in the wilderness. Weirdly, I kind of find that comforting because often life is hard. I think as I get older, I realize that life is full of problems. It's great being a Christian, but there are some really tough things that I and other people have to go through. And it's comforting to know that this isn't the promised land. This is a journey through the thirsty, hungry wilderness. The destination is going to be beyond my wildest dreams. Firstly, the route is hard. Secondly, the response. What is the response to this hardship? Firstly, the lack of water, Mara. Stop one. They come to Mara and they're really, really thirsty. They find water, it's bitter. How do they respond? Verse 23 of chapter 15, so flip back there. Verse 23, when they came to Mara, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Mara. How are they going to respond? So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" It's a pretty astonishing response, isn't it? If you think about what's happened already in the book of Exodus. These are the very same people that had walked through walls of water on either side as they're being chased by the Egyptians. These are the people that God has miraculously delivered from slavery in Egypt. They've just finished singing a song about God's power and his goodness, chapter 15. But then almost immediately, problem comes and they doubt his power and his goodness. I mean, it's absurd, isn't it? But there is one who does trust. Moses then cries out to the Lord, and the Lord delivers this gracious miracle. Verse 25, "Then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became fit to drink." Amazing. Surely that now seals it for them. The folder that they're gathering of reasons to trust God is pretty full. So surely they're going to put that into practice the next time they come to a problem. Let's find out. Chapter 16, verse 1. The problem is no bread. How are they going to respond? "The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community trusted the Lord and knew that he would deliver." No. It's incredible, isn't it? The whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. "The Israelites said to them, 'If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat round pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death.'" In other words, the situation is so bad now that it was better when we were in Egypt. It's the ultimate sign of ungratefulness and lack of trust, isn't it? We preferred being ruled by Pharaoh, that tyrant Pharaoh, than being ruled by you. Yet even despite their horrible rejection of him, the Lord graciously provides for them. Chapter 16, verse 11. "The Lord said to Moses, 'I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them at twilight they will be wiped out. I'm going to destroy them all.' No, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord." He carries on. "That evening quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, 'What is it?' They did not know what it was. Moses said to them, 'It is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Everyone is to gather as much as they need. Take an omer for each person you have in your tent.'" What is their response to his provision? Amazing provision. Verse 17, "The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little. Everyone had gathered just as much as they needed. Then Moses said to them, 'No one is to keep any of it until morning.'" Wow, they've learned to trust the Lord. They seem to be grateful for his provision, and they're obeying the instructions. Verse 20, "However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them." They don't trust God. This incredibly gracious God who's shown his power beyond doubt, they don't trust him. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Next stop, Rephidim. Again, problem. No water this time. Same problem. They camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Chapter 17, verse 1. What is their response going to be? But by now, surely they can trust the Lord. This folder that they're putting reasons to trust him in is overflowing. There are so many reasons to trust the Lord. Surely now they're going to trust him. Verse 2, "So they quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.' Moses replied, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?' But the people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, 'Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst. Again, the mind boggles as to how they can't trust him. It's absurd, isn't it? It's not just lack of intelligence. It seems to be a deeper issue, a hardness of heart issue. Not only has he saved them time and time again, he's met their needs time and time again. How will he respond to them? Amazingly, maybe even more amazing than their reaction, is his reaction to them. Chapter 17, verse 5, the Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink." It's amazing. Sometimes people say the Old Testament God is mean. This is grace upon grace. Not because the people deserve it. I mean, it's so clear. They do not deserve his grace. Grace upon grace, because in his nature, he is gracious and so, so patient with people that don't deserve it. What a wonderful God we have, and how wonderful it will be to spend eternity with that God in glory. Now, it's easy to sit here, isn't it, and go, "Huh, they're stupid, they didn't trust God." But I think so often we do the same, don't we? The water and the bread that are given here point us forward to the living water and the living bread that God gives us in the person of his Son, his only Son. Not because we deserve the gift. We are just like these grumbling Israelites. He gives us the gift because he is so gracious and so patient with us. The folder of reasons that we have to trust God is not just overflowing, it's drowning in reasons. When we think about the cross of Christ, we are totally reassured of God's love for us and his commitment to our good and his power to work everything for our good. Romans 8, verse 32, precious verse, says, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things?" I don't know if you've got a son. I guess there are some sons here this evening. It's a bit kind of weird to imagine, but imagine there was a situation where you voluntarily gave up your son to save me. I don't know what the situation that would be, but you had a choice between saving your son and saving me, and you gave up your son to save me. I would be totally convinced of that I could trust you, that you were committed to doing me good. As we look at the cross and we look at God giving up his son for us, we can be totally confident that along with him, along with Jesus who went to the cross by the Father's will, the Father will graciously give us all things. We don't need to doubt his provision for us, however hard circumstances might be. I think it's often Christians who've been through the hard times, who've been to the difficult places in the desert, who actually really understand this. I was really struck by when Neil Todman, the pastor in Bristol, spoke here a few years ago about his wife who'd recently died of cancer. There wasn't a hint of grumbling in his voice. If anyone had reason to grumble, it would be him. Wife died of cancer, two young sons. But he said, None of this has dented my confidence in the goodness of God. He totally trusts God because his trust in God isn't based on circumstances. It's based on the cross of Jesus. I've come up with something that you could call the grumble test to help us apply this in the daily life. Two questions we might want to ask when we face a trial that might cause us to grumble. Number one, do I believe God is in control? However hard this situation is, do I believe that he is in control of it? Yes. Number two, did he give his son for me? Two questions that get to the heart of whether or not we can grumble. Do I believe God is in control? Did he give us something for me? So you wake up with a cold on Tuesday morning. You think, oh, what? I don't need this. God, what are you doing to me? Do I believe he's in control? Did he give his son for me? In other words, do I believe that he's totally committed to my good? Or on a more serious note, someone very close to you is diagnosed with a terminal illness. Out of the blue, from nowhere. That would be so, so tough. Do I believe God is in control, even though that situation is so hard? Do I believe that he gave his son for me? By all means, cry out to him. Wrestle with him in prayer. Cry with brothers and sisters. But we have no reason to grumble when we look at the cross. So the route is hard. The response is to trust him, unlike the Israelites who grumble. And thirdly, the result. And firstly, we're going to look at the result for these people, which is found in Hebrews chapter 3. So we'll be in Hebrews 3 for the rest of the time, actually, so you can flick forward to that. And the result for the people is wrath. God's patience with them does finally run out, and he is angry with them. Chapter 3 of Hebrews, and I'm going to read verses 7 to 11. The writer is talking to people who, again, are wearied in the Christian life, tempted to give up. What does he say? So as the Holy Spirit says, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did in the rebellion during the time of testing in the wilderness, where your ancestors tested and tried me, though for 40 years they saw what I did. That is why I was angry with that generation. I said, their hearts are always going astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. The punishment for them is wrath, anger. God's patience runs out, not because they weren't moral enough, because they didn't trust him. And he shut them out of his rest, and they died in the desert. Verse 16, just a bit further down. Who were they who heard and rebelled? Were they not all those Moses led out of Egypt? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies perished in the wilderness? They just go round and round. Mara, desert of sin, Rephidim. They keep going round and they never make it to the promised land. Their bodies perish in the desert, the writer says. Now, what's the result for us? Do we just look at it and go, that's a shame for them? The result for us is warning. The writer says, do not be like them, in capital letters, as it were, in these chapters of Hebrews. You see them, whatever you do, don't be like them. We get a lot of positive role models in our society, don't we? Be like these people. This is a people who we are not to be like, whatever we do. At this point, we're going to have a bit of a visual aid, so if I could get my volunteers just to join me, well, down here. Now, this may look like George and Harry. They're actually Israelites, okay? And this may look like Wood Green Church building. This is actually the desert, the wilderness. And behind us is the Red Sea that we've just come from. Phew, got through that one. And out there in that lovely foyer is the Promised Land. And the task is the Israelites are walking through the wilderness, this thirsty, hungry, dry wilderness, and they're going to get to the Promised Land. Hopefully, you know, we'll find out what happens. So, first of all, they wander down, through this way, and they come to a place called Mara. And the problem is at Mara, there's no water. They grumble, and then the Lord provides water. Anyway, next stop, so they keep going, next stop, the desert of sin. Nothing to do with sin, just called the desert of sin. No food. They grumble. They haven't trusted the Lord. The Lord provides manna from heaven. There we go. And then they maybe come back this way a little bit, and they stop at Rephidim. Again, no water.
Oh.
Unbelievable. Can't believe they're not trusting the Lord. But amazingly, again, the Lord provides. But the point is, the Israelites never end up making it to that wonderful promised land out there. The rest of the chairs. They never make it. In fact, they end up dying in the desert. And the writer to the Hebrews says to us in 2019, he says today, the writer to the Hebrews says, look at these people. They didn't make it. They stopped trusting the Lord. And they perished in the desert. Chapter 4, verse 1 of Hebrews. Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you, none of us in this room, be found to have fallen short of it. For we also have had the good news proclaimed to us, just as they did, but the message they heard was of no value to them, because they did not share the faith of those who obeyed. Many years later, the writer of the Hebrews says, look at these people who didn't make it to the wonderful promised land, to the new creation that's better than anything we could ever imagine. They died in the desert. Their bodies perished in the desert. As you walk through the wilderness of this world, you will come across hardships, and they have the potential to knock you off track, to make you stop trusting the Lord for good. The writer of the Hebrews says, don't be like them. Keep trusting the Lord. So let me ask you, are you thinking of leaving Jesus? Are you considering giving up the Christian life? Maybe it's a circumstance that's changing. Maybe it's a battle with sin. Maybe it's a relationship that you're very tempted to continue with. The road is tough, but it's not a long road in the context of eternity. And the promise of entering the wonderful rest still stands.